We've been in a series for a few weeks now called The Seven Number One Reasons. Jesus in the Gospels, in a couple of different places, says, here's why I came. I came for this reason. And then another place he'll say, I came for this reason, and it's different. And another place he'll say it, depending on who he's talking to, another reason. And some of the writers of the New Testament will say, here's the reason Jesus came. Somebody else will say, here's the reason Jesus came. And they're different. So depending on who's listening, to whom the letter's being written, who is speaking, Jesus came for this reason. There's almost two dozen different here's why Jesus came. So for the last few weeks, we've grabbed a hold of just a few of those to talk about those. And today is kind of a twofer. We're gonna do two of them today. And they're really very, very similar. That's why we're going to do that. The other thing that you should know going into this message is that you have to finish it. That's always true, but I felt the urge to say that more today, as I'm going to say a bunch of words, and then you have to go figure out, you've got to go do it. So this is only going to be as effective as you, all right? So if you don't like the message, it's not my fault. It's yours. All right, so this is one of those times where it's just really, I believe God's up to something, and I've had some really cool conversations already today. The individuals and families and maybe some life groups of what God is up to and then you responding to it. And so that part's going to be up to you and how that plays out. We're going to start in the book of John, fourth book of the New Testament. So if you've got a Bible, open to the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. If you get to Acts, you've been too eager. We're going to start in John chapter 12. This is right after Jesus has walked up to the grave of Lazarus and said, Lazarus, step out, be less dead. This obviously gave Jesus quite a reputation. Lazarus was dead, now he is alive. So people are flocking to see and to hear Jesus take on the establishment, to take on tradition, to even take on death. And so people are asking, can I see Jesus? Can I speak to Jesus? And he responds, the hour has come. For the Son of Man, it's one of his favorite nicknames for himself. He's drawing from the Old Testament. The Son of Man to be glorified. Very truly, I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. How many of you think Jesus is teaching something about agriculture? What's he talking about? He's talking about himself. He's talking about death. If a kernel of wheat just stays a single seed and doesn't do what it's supposed to do, nothing happens. It has to detach from the source of life, be buried in the ground, and then life happens. Oh, Jesus is painting pictures with his words. Anyone who loves their life will lose it, while anyone who hates their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. So Jesus uses rhetoric a lot, like a lot of New Testament writers, to really get your attention. This can be grossly misunderstood. He's not saying you need to hate yourself, beat up on yourself, mistreat yourself so that the kingdom of God can be experienced. He's not saying that. He's saying, like he said in other places, he who tries to save, salvage, rescue his life makes his every day about how do I hang on? Your life that you're going after is going to slip right through your fingers. If your own purposes are your goal, you'll never, that's a bottomless pit, you'll never reach it. But if you follow the other-centered, self-sacrificial love of the kingdom, if you lose your life, put yourself second, well, that's how you'll find it. That's why he says, whoever serves me has got to follow me. You're going to follow me all the way into that kind of life. And where I am, my servant also will be. My Father will honor the one who serves me. And then I think he takes a deep breath and he says this, now my soul is troubled. And what am I going to say? Father, save me from this hour? Why is he troubled? Why is his heart beating fast? Why is his stomach in a knot? Because he's not talking about gardening. He's going to, in a matter of weeks or maybe days, be arrested, made fun of, beaten, have parts of his beard ripped out, spit in his face, mocked, put on a mock trial, scourged, tortured, and staked to a tree, naked for public humiliation. Why is he troubled? It's troubling. And another place in the New Testament, it says that before the night before this, in the Garden of Gethsemane, he's praying, God, if there's a way out of this, take it. Father, if there's a way out of this, I will take it. And he's so stressed that he has a legitimate medical reaction that we see sometimes today where blood is coming out of his pores. He's sweating drops of blood. He is so stressed and troubled. Now my soul is troubled, but what am I going to say? Father, bail me out of this hour? No. It was for this very reason I came to this hour. This moment is why I'm here. What am I going to do, bail? Father, glorify your name. My soul is troubled. My heart is beating. This is going to be difficult, painful. It's going to hurt, but I'm not going to turn my back on it. Father, glorify your name. This is why I'm here. Jesus can be heard saying, this is a challenge. This is uncomfortable. Yes, this is troubling, but this was never just an idea for me. This was never just a concept that I approved of. What I'm about to do was never just an idea, something true and beautiful. Hey, don't forget, sacrifice is really, really beautiful. It's what all your best hero stories are about giving. This has never just been true. This is about what I'm going to do. I'm going to embrace this. What am I supposed to do? Okay, I don't want to do it. Too painful. No, this is why I came. So a couple chapters later, Jesus is handcuffed, speaking to Pontius Pilate, kind of the governor of the area, representative of the empire of Rome. And these two are face to face, and they're having a conversation, and they're a little snarky, going back and forth. And Pontius Pilate is like, "Hey, if you're so big and popular, why did your own people turn you in? Are you a king?" And Jesus sarcastically says back. So sarcasm is a Christian value. Embrace that in your home. Jesus goes, "Oh, did you figure this out by yourself, or did somebody have to tell you?" And I imagine Pontius Pilate going, "No." That's in my mind, that's what he did. So they're having this exchange, and then Jesus says in John chapter 18, "My kingdom isn't of this world." Are you a king? "My kingdom isn't of this world." Now, don't read that and think that what he's saying is, my kingdom is up in the sky. My kingdom's on another planet. It's totally otherworldly. Don't think of it that way. The Greek could be rendered, "My kingdom isn't derived of this world." In other words, Jesus is saying, my kingdom doesn't come from a natural progression of the kingdoms of mankind. And my kingdom isn't the best of the worst. My kingdom isn't the natural evolution of got it wrong, getting better, better, better. Jesus, it's not derived from this world. If my kingdom were derived from this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I wouldn't be handed over to the Jews. This is important. You hear what Jesus is saying. If my kingdom were simply an extension of the empires and kingdoms of man, all of my servants would think they were doing me a favor by resorting to violence and ugliness. Do you see that? No, because this is a totally different kind of kingdom. Totally different kind of paradigm. As it is, my kingdom isn't of this realm. It's not from here. And therefore, Pilate said to him, "Oh, so you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I'm a king. For this I've been born. And for this I have come into the world. For this I have come into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Interesting that he doesn't say, "Everybody that's of the truth reads my words." Because we can confuse that. Everybody who's of the truth reads their Bibles. Doesn't say that. He says, "Here's my voice." He thinks it's a voice that can be heard. And last time in John that he talked about voice, he was talking about the sheep always recognize the voice of their shepherd. That's why they follow him. This is about leadership and followership. Those that are of the truth, they listen to me. They go where I go. They do what I tell them to do. There's a couple other words I want you to pay attention to. "For this I was born. This is why I came, to testify to the truth." The word testify comes from the Greek word that's essentially martyr. When you think of the word, if you're like me, if you think of the word testify or give testimony, you think about somebody sitting answering questions in court. Give me the facts. Lay it out. Bullet points. What happened? Give me the facts of the proper order at the proper time. That's a testimony for a lot of us in our heads. But when you find out that it comes from the word martyr, martyr came to mean people that would live all the way until they would die for what they believed. And Jesus is using the word in both senses. This is not just an idea that I'm going to try to talk you into. I didn't come to tell you things. I'm going to present, to martyr for things. I'm going to put it on display. The word truth, this is going to be tricky if you don't get this for the rest of our time this morning. When you hear truth, don't think of it the way that you've thought of it perhaps since that you were a child. Where truth is like, that's the not false. That's the winning argument. That's the last word, truth, capital T. There's nothing else to be said. That's the center winning idea concept. It's not what he's getting at. Jesus says, I've come to martyr to the truth. And the word truth is translated from a Greek word, aletheia. You see a in front of a word, it undoes it. It makes it a negative. And so it means to uncover. And so the kind of truth that he's talking about could be better understood by us to mean reality. Not simply truisms, not simply conceptual truth, but the uncovering, raw, naked reality. I have not come to try to talk you into something. I didn't come to affirm things that are true. I came to put reality on display. And those that are of reality, they listen to me. They follow me. And when it gets uncomfortable, Jesus says, well, what am I going to do? Say, Father, I'm going to bail? No. I step into the hour and all the way through the hour. Because Jesus isn't just about ideas. The truth for Jesus isn't the winning argument. Jesus is about taking his troubled spirit and stepping all the way into a moment. Jesus came to take a bunch of nouns, holy, sacred nouns, and make them verbs. And he says, my people aren't people of ideas, mere truths either. My people are people who dive in, that follow me into the hour that they have been presented. You'll notice if you watch the people who are called by my name that they are faced with an hour and they're troubled, but they step into and all the way through with the momentum of the kingdom. Jesus didn't come to present a bunch of static truths or a winning argument. Jesus came to live out reality. If all Jesus came to do is affirm truth, to say that's true, that's good, that's beautiful. If that's all he would have done, you would have never heard of him and we'd be stuck. What makes Christ and his ways so enduring, so endearing, is that Jesus takes his troubled spirit. Says, man, my heart's beating. My gut's in a knot. I'm sweating bullets. But what am I going to do? Bail when it matters most? What am I going to do? Get to the end of my life and simply say, I recognized truth when I saw it, but I didn't know what to do when I was confronted with reality? But what's so endearing and enduring about Jesus is he takes his troubled spirit and goes all the way through and says, Father, may your name be glorified. Glory in the Hebrew sense is simply a measurement word. The glory of something is the weight of it. Father, may your name be glorified isn't, God, please be proud of me. Please love me. God loves you no matter what you get around to doing or not doing. God, may your name be glorified is a way of saying, God, may your concept be given substance because of my faith. May your will and your kingdom and your intentions and what you want for humanity, for your kingdom, for all the earth, will be glorified. Will it suddenly have mass to it and substance? Because when you are faced with the hour that God puts before you and you step into it and go all the way through it, God gets glorified and everybody benefits. That's why Jesus is like, well, what am I going to do, bail out? No, I'm going to step into this so that God's name and reputation and will have gravity to it, and everybody will be a beneficiary. And it's the same for you. When you step into a moment, when we are people of reality and not simply exchanged truths, God's name and his will and who he is suddenly has substance for other people, and everybody benefits because we're all connected. But the thing is we prefer mere truth. There's power in it. I've got the truth. You think you have truth. Ha, lowercase t. This is what's true. We go back and forth. But it's all real safe because it's all conceptual. It's all real benign, sanitary, wrestling and exchanging nouns, ideas. We prefer it that way. So we'll check boxes, we'll take stances, we'll even go to church and vote based on truths. We like it that way because it's safe. But the problem is truths very seldom have any effect on reality. That there can be things presented to you as true that you can affirm as true and that not have an effect on your real day-to-day life. Think how many bits of news information are going to be in your phone and your laptop and your magazines and newspaper and all the news, for all the hope and the danger and this is going to shut down, but this is opening and blah, blah, and it's all true. Hey, does that affect real life? No, we just kind of keep doing our thing. Is it true? Oh, yeah. A buddy of mine, he was at a computer store a couple weeks ago and saw a woman make a fool of herself. She was very, very upset that the computer that she has wanted for a while wasn't available because of the routing issues that were came as a consequence of what had happened in Japan. And she was very upset at the inconvenience. She has wanted this computer for a while. And when it was explained to her, hey, don't know if you heard, Japan is experiencing one of the worst crises in its history. It's like that information wasn't even shared. Where is my computer? Now, is this woman evil? No. It's a great snapshot of the difference between what's true and what's real. Is it true that there was a really, really bad tsunami and an earthquake in Japan? Absolutely. She would affirm that. That's true. That is terrible. But what's real? Where's my computer? There's a vast difference between what's true and what's real. But Jesus wants to take us out of mere truths, the safety and the comfort of mere truths, and walk us into and through reality, that we would step into the hour that God has put before us and all the way into it, because that is when God's name is given substance and everybody benefits. Sometimes mere truth gives way to what's real. And that's where change and transformation happens. That's where the real story unfolds. There's no story in exchanging ideas. The story is when true becomes real and you step into it. A while back, I took my 5-year-old son, Ian, to the park, and he was going to ride his bike. And I was going to just walk behind him. I can do that for just a little bit longer because his wheels on his bike are like bagels. So he pedals as fast as he can and I can stroll. But I'm running out of time. He's getting bigger. And so my idea was we were going to go all the way around the lake. But I had in mind there's this one particular spot that I wanted to take him because it's prime real estate for snakes. There's the stream, there's overhanging grass, and then there's rocks and shrubs and sun and shade, and it's just a great spot to find snakes. And my idea was we'll go all the way around, and then Daddy and Ian will have daddy-son snake time, which I think is important. So we get all the way around, and we come to this one particular place at the end of our walk, and I look over the embankment, and sure enough, sunning itself on a rock is a snake. It was a banded water snake. I know that because I'm a nerd. Those are the things that I care about. I know how to look at a snake for the most part. I'm still learning a little bit in North Carolina. I have an easier time in Ohio. But that's a banded water snake. I know how to identify those features, and I'm looking at it, and that's a snake I want to catch. I know that it's not poisonous. There is no such thing as a poisonous snake. There are venomous snakes. Google the difference. That's my gift to you. Don't ever say poisonous snake. There's no such thing. And so those things matter to people who take snakes seriously, apparently. So sorry to get all worked up. That's just a pet peeve of mine. There. So with that off my chest, this snake was neither poisonous nor venomous. It can bite you, but that's more psychological than it is physical. I'm not worried about it. I'm going to catch this snake and show my son that that thing we're born with, where we're just not comfortable with snakes, isn't as necessary as he might think. Essentially, I'm going to beat the fear of snakes out of him, right? So, but not with a snake. So I crawl down the side of the embankment, and I'm just like, buddy, you see the snake? Yeah, Dad, I see the snake. And as I'm sneaking up to it, it dashes away, zigzagging up underneath some overhang. Drats, I didn't get it. Well, right as that happens, I'm standing in this stream, ankle deep, and I'm barefoot. I notice some movement off to my right, and as I look, literally a head is coming up like a gopher. It's a big, big snake coming up like a cobra. I'm not even playing the flute. This thing comes up. it pops its head out of the brush, and I'm looking at it, and I'm able to assess pretty quickly, this is a much older, much bigger banded water snake. This is a big snake. I'm going to catch this snake, I think. So I'm like, oh my gosh, do you see this snake? Well, Ian saw the other snake dart off. He's losing interest. And so I'm using my shadow to point to it because I'm still about 4 feet away. But did you see this big snake? I don't see the snake. Okay, I'm going to catch it for you. And right as I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to grab a hold of it, it goes back underneath and it starts to slither away. And there's no way I'm going to get it. It went up underneath. So I'm looking, but I keep hearing this and movement out of the corner of my eye. My first thought was, that's a rattle. This story is going to get really good. Then I realized it is a snake, and it's not a rattlesnake. What I'm hearing is twitching and leaves smacking against each other, and I look over, and I see this snake, and for the purposes of a good story, it was about this big around. I literally thought I was looking at a cowboy boot. It was huge, this gigantic mass of snake skin, and of course, it wasn't nearly this big, but I'm going to keep my hands like this. Here's the thing, is I'm looking, I go, oh my gosh, look at the size of this snake, and then I realize there are multiple snakes all wrapped together, and they're doing something. I mean, it's not even the weekend, and I think I know what they're doing, and they're twitching, and they're enjoying each other, and I'm like, I've never seen this before. So I'm trying to take pictures of this behavior. I'm pretty sure I recognize what this behavior is, and right as I get up just a few feet away, I'm beyond safety now, right? And so I come up, and from underneath the grass comes snake number one. Turns out, he's a sentry. He's going to protect this activity that's going on, and he comes very quickly, and I step back, and he zigs for my other available foot. I step back, he zags for my other, and now I'm stepping backwards, and he's getting faster and faster, and I can actually hear Johnny Williams' music, dun 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 dun, and I'm going, oh, and then he starts snapping at me, and there was no sound. I like to think there was a chomping sound, but he's snapping at my feet like a dog, and I'm stepping backward, I'm going faster and faster, and I'm thinking, my son's watching this, try to keep your cool, but it comes up underneath me and snaps up, and I jumped. I wish I'd had a basketball because I could have dunked with my feet. I went so far up into the sky that, but here's the thing, as I'm going up, I made a sound I didn't know I could make. Serious, like it was like, do you know the kids, the little funny corrugated straws that you blow that make that whistle? Like think elk mating call. I jumped up into the air, and in one motion, I land on the embankment, and I just start tearing my way up the side. I've completely lost my mind at this point. Now the details are a little fuzzy, but what's absolutely clear in my mind is there's a second sound, because I'm going up the side going, what was that noise? Oh, that was me. And then I hear this other sound, and it's the sound of tearing and ripping. And I get all the way back up, panting next to my son. Hey, buddy, did you see that? And I look down, and I have torn my shorts from the inseam left all the way across the zipper. And there's no way that I can put this together. I'm essentially wearing a really bad kilt at this point. And I look down, and I got really self-conscious. And when I get self-conscious, I immediately see myself through other people's eyes. And it's broad daylight in the middle of a park, and all I can think of, here's this guy that squeaks and screams with a torn pair of pants with a 5-year-old. Call the cops, you know? And so I just clutched my pants like this, pulled my shirt down, and said, buddy, let's get some lunch. What do you say? And I put him in the van. And so we get back to the house. I'm serving him lunch, and he just kind of stared and poked at his lunch. And the look on his face was kind of like, are you really the dad I get forever? Here's the frustrating thing. Guess what kind of snake it was? A banded water snake. They're not venomous. It's true. That is a true statement. That's not up for debate. It's a banded water snake. I even got a picture of it, looked it up later. It's true. I knew it was true. But reality showed up on the front door. I squeaked and said, I need to get out of here. And the difference between true and real could not have been more crystal clear for me. Because knowing about things isn't where the good story lies. It's when reality shows up and you actually step all the way into it. When you're confronted with reality. Truths can be beautiful. They can be good. For crying out loud, they're true. But reality is why we're here. Real life is the point. And Jesus wants to bring us all the way up to the hour that God has put before us. And maybe it's epic. Maybe it's big. Maybe it's just this day-to-day thing. The hour that God puts before you. And say, will you take your troubled spirit, take your fear, take your anxiety, take it with you. Acknowledge it. And go all the way through it. Because the story and the transformation is on the other side. Don't turn your back on it. Step all the way through and give God's name and his kingdom substance and watch everybody around you benefit. So you talk about discipline. Everybody knows that taking care of your mind and your body is good and true and beautiful. I don't care what age you are in this room, you would say, yes, it's good. It's better than the alternative. Take care of yourself. It's the only body you got. Take care of your mind. It's good. It's true. It's beautiful. And then 9:33 p.m., you're watching TV and your stomach growls, and you hear the faint cries, your own name coming from the cupboard. It's the family-sized Duncan Hines brownies, and it wants some attention. No. You don't eat past 8 o'clock. That's true. That's good. That's beautiful. But now reality's here. Now what do you do? That's the difference between true and real. Everybody thinks honesty is a better program than the alternative. Integrity. Who that guy is when he's by himself or at church or at work, in the cafeteria, or at the game on a Friday. He's always the same guy. Integrity, I trust him. It's beautiful. It's good. It's true. You affirm it. You defend it. You would say, that's better. You're a fool for saying that it's not the better way to go. And then you're doing your taxes. Well, if I write down this extra income that nobody knows about, it's going to cost me. And I don't remember there being a government agent present when I did this work. And so I'm not writing it down. If I don't cut this corner at work, I'm not going to make the extra money that would make my family's life easier. If I cut this corner, it will make me money. Integrity, it's beautiful, it's true. But now that reality has showed up, I've got a different decision to make. Forgiveness, you tired of hearing that word yet here? At the center of redemption is forgiveness. When you punish people, it doesn't redeem them. It doesn't deal with the sin. The only way to deal with sin is to forgive it. That's the only way to wipe it out. Forgiveness is at the center of you and I coming back together and us coming back together with God. Redemption and forgiveness are the same thing, and we know that it's beautiful and good and true. And then you go home for Thanksgiving, and there's the face. Now, it's not a concept. Now, it's got a face and a name and a story, and you say, nope, I love the truth, but now reality is here. No. Nope. Loving unlovable people. What people need is love. Man, love straightens people out. Love is a great program, man. People that are broken, didn't get the attention they needed or wanted from mom and dad. And if you just love people, it really straightens people. Love covers a multitude of sin. Love makes the world go round. And then the guy at work that makes the inappropriate comments all the time to the women about their skirts, and you're like, I just wish he would die. He is not lovable. It's not that he's hard to love. He doesn't deserve love. Oh, now that reality has showed up on the front door, now we see the difference between what's true and what's real. Marriage vows are a great, great reminder for me. I did a wedding yesterday. I get to do weddings ever so often, officiate weddings, and I like it because I say very similar things at each of the weddings. And the vows are a great reminder. It always snaps me to attention as a husband. The vows that I've had so many people say. Vows that you've heard before. It sounds something like this. I, Steve, take you, Christy, to be my wife. To have and to hold from this day forward. For better, for worse. Can you imagine a more sweeping statement? For when things aren't good and for when they are. Okay, that pretty much covers it, right? For richer, for poorer, when we have money and when we wish that we did. In sickness and in health. Like the health part, I get that. But like even during the man cold. All the way through that. Promise. And then when we get older and sickness means something else. When our when our minds slow down. To love and to cherish. When's the last time you used that word? Cherish, to love and to cherish until we're separated by death. As God is my witness, I give you my promise. You know why we get weepy at weddings? There's a couple reasons, and one of them, it's those words, because they're true, and they're beautiful, and they're ancient. They're good. And then 4 years later, you're pacing the floor in your living room, and you're saying, this isn't working out. This is not working out. Why? I'm not happy. I didn't say happy. Not one time. I've never used the word happy. You didn't commit to happy. Do you know how many times I'll have young couples, they'll come to me, hey, we want to get married. We want to write our own vows. Oh, that's so stupid. You've never been married before and you're going to say, this is, you know, we're going to step into the stream of history and say, this is what we're vowing, you know? But I get it. But even when I get really, really weird vows and all the things that people think that they want to say, and then in 20 years, you're going to be like, I can't believe I said that. But even when I read those, I have never, ever, ever, even in a personally crafted vow, seen the words, I will love you so long as you keep me happy. Why? Because it's not true. It's not good. It doesn't have beauty to it. Can you imagine hearing that during a wedding? Honey, I'm going to give myself to you so long as you make it worth it. No, that's not good. That's not true. Boo, throwing shoes, all of that. But 4 years later, oh, this isn't working. Downward spiral. Why? Because this is hard. Right. That's why you don't make vows to eat. That'll come naturally. This is, you made vow. See, true, it's beautiful. Real is later when you're like, man, we need some help. We need to go to counseling. We need to talk to somebody. I need to continue to lift you up. We've got to get raw, real, stop messing around with this thing, because now that reality is here, we've got to make true turn into real, or this doesn't work. And if you're not married, if you're single, it's no different. When we're talking about loving people, you'll run into people that you'll go, oh man, that's why love is a command. Because it's not coming real natural right now. The whole Bible is summarized in love people. You have to be told to do it. And what kind of God would command you to feel something? It's not talking about a feeling, because you won't feel like it. Have this mood. What? Love them. It's true for all of us. When true runs out of steam because reality has shown up, that's where Jesus says, no. I know your spirit's troubled. Step in, and all the way through it, God gets glorified. Everybody benefits. Light into darkness, heaven to earth, beauty, 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 substance, reality. And this isn't just to eat your vegetables sermon either. There's another side to this. There are some of you that have crazy talent and creativity, and you don't use it. And this is from my heart to yours. That you learned somewhere in your life that what you could make doesn't matter, that it's stupid. And it's writing, and it's sculpting, and it's painting, drawing, storytelling. It's a whole other side of your brain that you don't use, because people that use that side of their brain are, you've been told, they're weird, they don't make money, and I can't take that serious. That's for irresponsible kids or whatever, and blah, blah, blah. I'm doing this with my tie on. And then you leave those meetings, you get in your car, and what do? You turn the radio on, because it's true. And it's beautiful for them to make music, but not you. And you go home and you've got pictures on your wall that other people did. Well, because it's true. It's beautiful. It's good. It's just not real enough for me to do it. And you're ripping me off. You're ripping other people in your role. Oh, you can do something, but you have decided that it's true. It's good. It's beautiful, but it's not real, and you won't dive into it. There are job opportunities that some of you won't jump into because somebody won't take it seriously. And I've talked to people about this, and some people won't step into job opportunities, giving their life to a career that actually means something, because 3 decades earlier, their father said, you can't do that. You won't amount to anything. And they're trying to outrun that phrase. They don't even realize it. I can't do this kind of work. Nobody will take it seriously. I can't do that. But it's true, it's good, it's beautiful. It's not real. I'm not. That's for somebody else. Missionary work? I mean, the local, non-exotic, giving your life for other people in some fashion, all the way to the exotic, I'm going to wear flip-flops and drink dirty water for the rest of my life on behalf of other people, knowing that salvation doesn't mean a ticket punch, that it's holistic, that salvation is huge, it has everything to do with everything. And they stand up on stage and they talk and you give your money and you say, that's true, that's beautiful, that's good, but not you. Why? I don't know. It's just not real. I can't step into it. And God doesn't love you less, but life, the story, isn't unfolding the way that it was supposed to. And here's a tangent, because frankly, some of us, the issue is, man, I'd love to step into that, but it's what I have to step out of. It's this old limiting circumstance that I agreed to, that my family agreed to. And it wasn't evil, but it says all my no's and my yeses for me now. This old way of looking at life, this old way of looking at how of what you're actually able to do, it says all my no's for me. A buddy of mine, he did a presentation for a couple of us, and he was illustrating just what it is that keeps men and women in career fields that they can't stand all the way to retirement. What is it that keeps people unhappy? They'll stay locked in this thing for the rest of their lives. And I had my pencil and my paper. I'm like, give me the list, man, because this is going to help me do what I do. He wrote one word on the board, mortgage. I was like, what are the other words? That's really too narrow. No, that's it. That's it for so many of us. I would like to do, I would like to be, this is the hour that I have come for. Man, I was made to do this. Oh, but the house, I can't. Maybe next year, maybe next year, maybe next, aren't you tired of that phrase? Maybe next year. What a nightmare to think that God has created me to do something and to present to me an hour and with a knot in my stomach and my heart beating to say, this is why I came, this is it, and then to find out, oh, the obstacle is something I put there years ago, months ago, something I haven't challenged in a while. I would step into it, but man, it's going to cause so much pain to step out of this other thing. What a nightmare. I don't know what your deal is. I don't know what it is that you're facing, or maybe a better way to put it is what you won't face. For young and old alike in this room, there might be just this day-to-day habitual way of dealing with people, dealing with resources, dealing with the way that you treat this person so to gravitate to this person, dealing with forgiveness issues, bitterness, the way that you see faith and God. And all it could be epic. It could be huge. It changes 2012. Totally changes the trajectory of your family's life. I don't know where it is on that scale. But I want to ask you a couple of questions. I'm going to use some key words. I want you to think about these words, and I want you to see what resonates. Is the thing that you're facing going to take courage? Is the thing that you're facing going to take endurance? Is the thing that you're facing going to take patience? Or the biblical word for patience, long-suffering? Is the thing that you're facing going to take an increased pain tolerance? Is the thing that you're facing, is it going to take thick skin? Is the thing that you're facing, will it take trust? Like naked, oh, vulnerable trust? Will it take naivete? I'm going to look a little stupid doing this. Is the thing that you're facing, does it require that you part from norms, standards, that your family, that society, whatever? Man, that's going to be a little isolating. That makes my heart beat. That troubles my spirit. Is the thing that you're facing going to take faith? Not the faith that got you here this morning. That's good, but it's not enough. I'm talking about the verb form. Like, I'm going to reorient all of my interests and the trajectory of my life. All that's faith, that kind of faith. Is it going to take faith? Man, I've got a lot more unanswered questions than answered questions. Is it going to take that? I just want to say, if it's one of those words, or maybe words like it, it might be the hour that God has brought to you to say, will you step into it? So that my name can be glorified. He's not a megalomaniac. He just knows when what he wants has substance, man, the world gets pretty. Will you step all, would take your fast beating heart and the pain and the fear and your troubled spirit and go all the way through it and glorify my name and so you can bless everybody around you? Will you do it? May we be a community that recognizes that it might trouble our spirits. It might very well be very uncomfortable for a short or a long-term period. but that if we'll listen for his voice and have the courage to actually do what he says and to follow him all the way through the hour that we're presented, he, our God, and his will suddenly have mass and substance that people will point to and go, hey, that's way better than a concept. He's glorified, and our world becomes blessed. And we will say we are people that live, that actually live our lives. May you be deeply disturbed. And may you be blessed deeply with his peace. We'll see you next week.